It's a woman who says her conservative Indian upbringing in the state of Bihar, East India, was actually the perfect grounding for someone who would end up as a sex coach. It sounds like fascinating content, and I'm very pleased to be able to play that for you now.
Pallavi, welcome to Weekend Breakfast. An absolute pleasure having you on the show. Yours is a really, really fascinating story. And I love that you have said that your upbringing, a very conservative Indian upbringing, actually lent itself to you becoming ultimately one of the country's leading intimacy and sex coaches. Can you tell us why it is that you say that?
Okay. So, yeah, my personal journey has been a large reason for me becoming an intimacy coach, because from the first hand, you know, right from the childhood, I was coming across experiences, whether it was discovering my own parents, you know, relationship outside the marriage, or even finding being sexually abused by a neighbor as a child, or even discovering those magazines which kind of just which are just titillating about sex without talking anything about a healthy and responsible interaction between two adults. So it was more like, you know, used as a spice to sell off a magazine by those putting those graphic pictures. So all of it was something which I would say ideally should not be, you know, child should not be exposed to, because a child is impressionable. And these were the things. So even though our society is really lip-tight, it's really closeted about sexuality, at the same time, there is this growing number of magazines, movies, you know, so many other sources that kind of just bring sexuality to the forefront in a very obscene way. So that was something which was always a question for me, that why is this happening? And then secondly, also, like, you know, right from the first experience of having periods, it was all, you know, deeply uncomfortable. My mother kind of just, she handed me over this cloth and she said, okay, you go and you put this cloth inside your underwear without any discussion, because she was also clueless. She did not know why periods happen, and periods are considered to be dirty. The clothes have to be disposed in, you know, a place where it is like something which is, no one can go there. No one should go there. Even while putting the clothes, I felt that, okay, this is something, it's a blood soaked cloth. You know, there's so much of baggage that I carried around my periods.
Paint a picture, if you will, for us about the state of sex education, both when you were in India, both when you were growing up and now. And I suppose one of the things that sort of as a tail ender to that is that as much as a society, people may not want to speak about sex and it becomes this sort of rather shameful thing, it's still happening. So actually it becomes counterproductive, which I'm sure which is part of why you do what you do. It becomes counterproductive not to talk about it, because in that silence and the hiding of it becomes shame, and people's behavior when they feel shame can become very, very problematic. But let's talk a little bit, if you could just paint a picture of sex education in India.
Well, things have not moved enough, except I would say with the internet, with the onset of internet, the youngsters have a stool where they can go out and they can Google it, because I am 38 now. So at my time, there were these, you know, big machines, and I have to go to a cyber cafe. I did not have a smartphone in my hand. So I think that's the change. But the problem is that, you know, there is so much of junk on the internet. It is not reliable. It is not accurate, and anything and everything. There are so many opinions. It's not a scientifically credible information, and it might not suit me, because every person is different. Every individual is different. So I would say in my society, primarily, internet is the source of sex education. People, youngsters have smartphones. They have got this growing independence where they can experiment with their sexuality. They can have a casual sex. They can have a live-in relationship. So, but then I would say the protectiveness, in the sense that not to really guard yourself, but to be empowered. I think we have a long way to go there, because I simply say that, you know, you being sexually empowered has nothing to do with number of partners you have slept with. Mm. I mean, that's also a growing misconception that to be called as sexually liberal, I need to have casual sex, or I need to be, going to orgies, or I need to be seen as this person. But I think it's as much about the value system, which is not based on morality, but which is based on individual preferences. Say a girl who might be having casual sex with a boy in the hope of forming a long-term relationship should know that it might not happen. And then is she prepared to deal with a heartbreak thereafter? Or a girl, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, you say that you were 25 when you lost your virginity, and you were still sexually inexperienced when you were married. It was an arranged marriage a couple of years later. You've described your wedding night as a fiasco. Tell me why that is.
So mine was an arranged marriage. So India, we still have this custom of marriages being arranged by parents, where the parents arrange the meet of a bride and a groom, and they kind of sit together, and the whole decision is being taken in 10 minutes. So in 10 minutes, you have to tell that, okay, I like this person. And then this is socially announced. So once there is a social announcement in your community, you can't really go back and break that promise. So I would say that time my marriage was fixed in just a matter of 10 minutes. And now when I look back and I kind of laugh it off, and I can say, okay, how ridiculous is that to really be pressurized to choose someone's life partner in 10 minutes? But then I did that, and it is still being done by so many couples and families here. So especially in arranged marriages, it is, there is this correlation of virginity and purity. If you are not a virgin girl at the time of marriage, you are considered impure, or you are considered of a woman with a loose character. And this is more for women, not for men. So it was very evident to me that if I disclose that I have had sex before marriage, that marriage would not have taken place under any situation. So my parents said that you don't have to disclose it. You have to keep quiet, which I was like, with a lot of difficulty, I agreed, because, you know, this is how it is going to happen in every alliance that my parents would be looking for. Now, on the wedding night, I had fears, and surprisingly, I still get asked these questions by young girls that, ma'am, what do we do if our husbands come to know on the wedding night that we are not virgins? So basically, there is a still hymen, which everyone thinks, again, thanks to internet, who has kind of exaggerated the concept of hymen. And a young girl, she is threatened and intimidated that what if her husband gets to know if she hasn't bled, or if her vagina is loose, even though if she has one sexual encounter. That's the level of fear she is carrying, and anxiety she is carrying. That anxiety and fear was in my body also. So I kind of squeezed it to pretend that, yes, I'm having this pain, and, you know, I'm so trying to really enact the whole scene of being a virgin.
I'm fascinated to know, Pallavi, how you are viewed now. I mean, you are one of the leading intimacy coaches in the country. You've written a book. How are you viewed? I mean, presumably as a complete hero by women, but just generally in society now in India, are the times changing? Are people who do the work that you do viewed with a sense of these are professionals who can help us with our relationships? Or is there a bit of a, do you face a bit of criticism, a bit of backlash for being so open about sex and sexuality in a country that is still quite conservative?
Yeah, so, I mean, just yesterday my Instagram account got blocked. I lost 17,000 followers all in a day, because the policies could not differentiate between sex education and promiscuous sexual content. Sure. You know, that's how policies are so weird and restrictive. And that is how we associate sex as. The moment you read sex, you assume that, okay, there is something which is obscene, or which is something which is lurid about it. You know, that's a de facto image of sex that has been built, and everyone is like, okay, all the platforms, and I don't really blame them, because that's how it's by and large. So what was the question?
No, I just wondered how you are viewed, whether you face criticism about the way that you are so open about sex.
Sara, I mean, one of the reasons that I chose to stick to this field. So me coming to this space was purely a serendipity. Like, you know, it was not really planned. I started blogging, I started writing, and then in the course of time, I started getting stories from people. And the number of stories increased so much in so less of a span of a time that I was forced to really consider it as a career choice, because I was like, okay, there is no one talking about it and there are so many problems. And I'm seeing those problems firsthand. Being an empathetic person, I really empathize with these people that, okay, they have nowhere to go. So there has been a lot of support backstage. But when it comes to forefront, I would say it's just maybe a 10% of the overall support. Even talking about my personal life, you know, I always get, there is this friend of mine, she's a very dear friend, and she said that Pallavi, for Indian men, it's still a large way to go before they accept a wife who is a sex coach or who is a sex educator. And trust me, this is definitely, I would say, yes, true for a large number of male population, because when it comes to families, our families are bound by religion. You know, that religion is something which is a symbol of purity and symbol of chastity and a symbol of sexlessness. So if you're seen as a religious family, there is no talk of sex. So my work comes directly in conflict with that. And yes, that's a social, thankfully media has been very supportive. All the social platforms, they have been supportive. Media has particularly been very supportive. I've been featured almost in all national media. But when it comes to really families at the like, you know, I would say grassroots level, there's a lot of challenge in acceptance as a member that, you know, I am a person, I'm a human being. I have these connections, I have these emotions. To be accepted on a personal level, to know that, okay, I talk about sex, it doesn't mean that, you know, I cannot have healthy connections. I mean, this is something on a very educational context and I would say empowering context I'm working on. It's different than, I should go on to say, it's different than sex work. You know, you have to differentiate. It's not the same. Sex educator is different than a sex worker. And by that, I don't kind of banish or I don't kind of look down or degrade sex worker. But that's what is the divide between the good girl and the bad girl. So if the girl is sexy, she is slutty. If the girl is good, then she is like, you know, she's worshipped as a goddess. That's the dichotomy.
I just want to end by talking about, like South Africa, India has some of the highest rates of rape and sexual violence against women in the world. The fact that you are speaking and you are, with your education, empowering women, do you think that there will be a connect? The more we have these, the more we have these discussions, the more we let women educate women on their rights. Do you think that there is a correlation between that? Because to suggest that is quite controversial, because it almost puts the responsibility of the rapist on women, which is abhorrent, actually.
I agree. And I would say, you know, that is what can be expected out of a society which is highly, highly, you know, sexually conservative. By conservative, I mean that you have banned sex education. Sex education is banned in many, many Indian states. There is no, again, parents are lashing out and you are not preparing your young kids for a healthy sexuality, adult sexuality. Instead, they are going to porn. They're going to movies which are highly misogynistic, and they're learning from there that the hero has entitlement over the hero, the woman. The man has an entitlement because he's seen as this masculine figure. He's seen as an alpha male, and alpha male means that you are muscular and you have that strength and you can woo a woman. Now, wooing is different than stalking, but no one actually understands that. In our films, women are stalked in the name of wooing and they eventually say yes. So the mainstream movie is basically driving home the message that it's okay to stalk a woman. It's okay to just expect her to say yes. And it's okay to just straight away go. And this is what happens with me. You know, a lot of men come and say, okay, what's your phone number? What's your WhatsApp number? There is no understanding of consent. It's so sad.
The term that you use, which I think is so apt, is entitlement, and it's about disrupting the patriarchy that allows for rape to be an acceptable phenomena
almost of that culture, which is not, as we've discussed, it's not specific to India. We experience the same here in South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even though this is such a strange thing, which I've even like firsthand witnessed, that I conducted a workshop here on BDSM, which was, again, there was nothing sexually explicit. It was all about consent, safety, communication. And it was a very basic level where I just talked about blindfolding or handcuffing. So we did not even have. Now, this got trolled, and women especially, they said, OK, we are not going to let this workshop happen in India. And there was, I was like, you know, every they tagged all the politician parties and all the NGOs, I don't know, all the ministry, they tagged and they said, okay, this girl needs to be behind the bar. And sure. I was like, okay, I checked the law. It was all legal that I was doing, because my workshop was purely conceptual. There was nothing physical here, but they jumped into this assumption. So even though we want to minimize rapes, but we are not open to talk about pleasure consent.
Yeah.
Pleasure is something we feel we are so uncomfortable talking about pleasure, and we say that, okay, rapes have to go. There is to be a balance. Like, you know, you need to talk. You can't just keep talking about crimes and thinking that, okay, something will change. You need to talk about consensual, respectful adult sexual activity, which is everyone is uncomfortable. It's okay to talk about crime, but it's not okay to talk about, you know, pleasure. But I think pleasure is the way forward.